Good morning. My name is Raina Wells, and I'm the Director of Business Affairs and Research at the Ontario Media Development Corporation. On behalf of OMDC, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the fourth in our series of Digital Dialogue Breakfasts. I'd like to thank PwC for its support of this series, and also to thank our panelists for taking the time to participate. I'm sure that many of you know that OMDC is an agency whose mandate is to build Ontario's creative economy. Through a range of innovative programs and funding for the book and magazine publishing, film and television, music, and interactive digital media industries. We're proud that Ontario has a strong track record of support for our creative industries, and that OMDC has the privilege of being part of that support. This morning's session is on leveraging collaboration, how to successfully leverage collaboration arrangements to achieve your business goals. Our moderator this morning is Lisa Coleman. Lisa is a partner in PwC's Audit and Assurance Group and part of the firm's Technology, Communications, Entertainment, and Media Practice. Please join me in welcoming Lisa Coleman.
Thank you, and welcome to the fourth and final session for this season. Appreciate you coming. And also, again, would like to thank our panelists. We're going to have each of the panelists introduce themselves, and they've either got a presentation or a clip about their company, so you understand how they contribute to the dialogue this morning. And then we'll have some questions amongst the panelists, and then if you would like to ask questions, please do, as that makes it the most engaging. I have pretty boring questions. You guys will have more interesting questions. So I want to first introduce the topic, as Raina has this morning. We do an entertainment and media outlook every year, and last year we said that strategic alliances and collaboration were key to the success of media and entertainment companies. And I think you'll find this morning that each of the panelists will talk about how they're using collaboration and strategic alliances to further their business endeavors. So I'd like to, I'll just quickly run down the row and introduce each person. So Sandra Singer, during the day, she's an auditor. Sorry, Sandra. At night, though, more importantly, she is a director with the Open Roof Festival. So she's going to talk about the Open Roof Festival and how they're using collaboration in order to engage and make people aware of Open Roof. And so if you haven't heard of Open Roof, this is part of her collaboration. She's going to make you aware of Open Roof today. Next is Peter Kozak. He works at ARC Productions. So ARC Productions is a large production company in Toronto, and he's going to talk about some great ways that they're doing strategic alliances. And then I've got Strawn. He's a little bit different from a company perspective, but he's going to explain why he's here. He's not a media company, but partners with a number of media companies. So again, we'll talk about that. And then at the very end, I've got Philippa from Marble Media, which again is a production company and does a lot of digital work in the space. So she'll also talk about how Marble Media is working with partnerships and strategic alliances. So I'm going to start with Sandra. I've got your slides. You want me to start with those? Oh, there you go. Flip over.
So, hi everybody, I'm Sandra Singer. I'm a director at Open Roof Festival. So, Open Roof Festival started in 2010. It actually started at Canada 3.0, which I'm sure a lot of people know about. It was sort of hatched over a lunch conversation I had with a friend from work and a gentleman named Michael McMillan, who works at Blue Ant. So we talked about Open Roof. The idea of it sort of started with Hot Docs, which is a documentary film festival in the city that had brought up an organization from the U.S. Called Rooftop Films New York to do an outdoor screening in their festival. And we sort of talked about that screening and how it would be really a great thing for Toronto. There's tons of film festivals, which I'll talk about a little bit later, but not that many that marry film and music. And Toronto is just such a great environment for indie film and music. So we thought it'd be a great way to showcase Canadian content and also some festival darlings from the U.S. that wouldn't necessarily have had a theatrical run that Toronto audiences would be really excited about. So a night at Open Roof, we open up with an indie band from Toronto. This year we're going to have a couple of bigger names. So we have the Sheepdogs that are opening night playing for their documentary that premiered at Banff this year called The Sheepdogs Have At It. It's about the Sheepdogs and their rise to fame when they were on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. So after that, we have the film, and then there's a bunch of different activations where we collaborate with different partners in the city. So this is a picture of when Spin TO came out, and we had a ping pong tournament at the screening as well. And I'll talk a little bit about this later, but we focus a lot on engaging our audience. So there's a lot of competing film festivals, a lot of stuff happening in the summer, as everyone is going to hear more about. So how do we get people out to our screenings? A lot of it is the strategic partnerships that I'll talk about later today. And then just some press in terms of the festival. We've had a lot of good press coverage just because the festival is a little bit unique, sort of a modern urban drive-in. And we have a short film that I think we're going to show now just so you can see what it looks like at the festival from a couple years ago.
Peter Kozik, I'm with ARC Productions. I'm EVP and CFO at ARC. ARC is a animation and visual effects a company here in the city. We're independently owned. We used to be called Stars Animation. We have about 220 artists. We scale up to 300, and we some of the projects we've been working on. And I'm going to go right into the deck pretty quickly here, so if you can line that up. Romeo and Juliet, which is a feature film. So if you have kids, ages of 3 to 11, I'm sure your kids have seen it. And 9 is something else that we've worked on, another feature film. And then in terms of VFX, we've done VFX for Camelot. So TV series that's been it's been aired. We did all the dolphin work on Dolphin Tale, and then some just more of a recent work. If there's any gamers here, Halo 4 did a game release. Microsoft did a game release last year. We did the 75 VFX for the 75 minute pre-game release special, which you can now see on Netflix and iTunes and all that kind of good stuff. So when I got into ARC, I was actually blown away by the quality of work that we have here in the city in relation to that, and I got to know the all the other players, and it's actually quite interesting. So if you can just play, I think the best thing is just to see some of our reels. The first one is the go ahead. The first one is an animation reel.
Hello!
So I apologize for that. So my name is Strawn McCart, and I'm from Scalar. And I'm here to talk about our Scalar Studio Cloud Network. Scalar is an IT service delivery company that's been a national IT company for about 11 years. Though our Studio Cloud product's a specific service that we have introduced, and it's been on the market for about 18 months. It started in Vancouver, and we're bringing it to Toronto right now. So fundamentally, oh, I apologize, I didn't realize there were animations. You may have to click like crazy to get us through. Keep going. Actually, next slide, sorry. For us, we believe that Toronto can become the best jurisdiction in North America to shoot, edit, animate, post any VFX or CGI content, and even any media and entertainment content. We started by focusing on VFX and CGI, just given that the the needs and their demand for compute infrastructure were so high. But it's really about creating a network and a community of media and entertainment companies involved in any element of the production process. Next slide. So fundamentally, the reason that we saw an opportunity in the market is to try and match supply and demand. This is very, very difficult for media and entertainment companies to do because it is so heavily project-based. And the challenge that a lot of companies face is that they have to build up a specific amount of capacity to meet a particular project. And if the next project is several months, after the next, you have, or after the first one, you have a great deal of unused capacity. Or if you need a little bit more capacity than you have on staff, you're faced with a very difficult problem of having to purchase additional infrastructure that you really only need for a short period of time. And that is a difficult business problem to overcome because a lot of the fixed IT assets that you have to purchase are expensive, there are big capital outlays, and their utilization will vary during the over the period of a project. Next slide. So fundamentally, what Scalar Studio Cloud is a private, high-speed IT delivery service where you can buy the compute, storage, network, bandwidth, and software infrastructure either on a term or on-demand basis. You can also sell back any of the unused capacity for the periods of time where you don't need it back to members of that community. And it includes the delivery of the data center, 24/7 monitoring, and all of the management services that really aren't necessarily the core focus of what a VFX and animation or a media and production company's core focus really is. Running a data center, staffing up a 24/7 network operations center is not necessarily the core focus of what a lot of these companies want to do, and that comes fundamentally as a part of our service. So just some of the features very quickly. We have built out in Vancouver, and we're building out in Toronto, a private dark fiber network that allows you to access these services over a private line, over very, very high speeds. It's effectively an extension of your local area network. It's a secure, dedicated connection that can be delivered over a variety of speeds. And it also allows you to connect to a number of other studios, production companies, post-production companies across different parts of the value chain in the production process to collaborate, share files, share data, connect across networks. And that's really where the element of collaboration comes in. For us in Toronto specifically, we have one customer that's very early on in the stage and a number of other customers that are very, very interested. But where this becomes most useful is that as more and more customers come on board, the market for on-demand services gets much, much more liquid. You can much more easily sell excess capacity back. You can also connect much more easily with other members in the production process. So that's really, we are the railroad that enables collaboration. We ourselves are not a participant in the production process, but we just help connect you to other members of the community. And this is the Studio Cloud Network as we hope to see it one day in Toronto. It's our Studio Cloud data center connecting with a number of other hosting providers, production facilities, post-production facilities, transcoding facilities, peering networks, and internet access, all of which can be delivered to you privately, or you can interconnect between those companies should you have the need to for a particular project. This is a map of the proposed construction of the fiber optic path that we're going to be building out in the city, which the construction of the first phase will start as soon as permitting is done, which I'd like to think will be done in around 120 days. But this gives you a sense of where we're going to be across the city. If anybody wants to talk about what it's like building a fiber optic network in Toronto, you can talk to me after, over a drink, preferably. It's a complicated process, but we've done it before, and we're enthusiastic to continue to expand this network to accommodate more customers. Just briefly about the Toronto Studio Group, what we found to be very useful in Vancouver was some of the early adopter customers are really our best advocates for talking to other customers about why the service is appealing, why they should join. And we kicked off earlier this year the Toronto Studio Group, which includes a number of production post-production and government agencies just to talk about how this network, what this network could be. I mean, one of the things that's very appealing to us is the longer that we operate our Vancouver network and the prospects for the Toronto network is we have several products and services that we already have launched or that we have in mind, but it's really the opportunity for things that we haven't even conjured up yet that are the most appealing. Long-haul interconnect traffic between cities all over the globe, interconnecting with other shared media and entertainment networks, or even things that we haven't thought of yet. As we talk to more of our customers, and that's the purpose of the Toronto Studio Group, some of those things get fleshed out more. And that's really it. So I think I've blown through my time. Thanks very much.
Good morning. So I'm going to appeal to the child in you. Marble Media is a converged television and digital media company started by two smart guys graduates from Ryerson, who I guess very early on saw the collaborative essentials between television production and digital media production. So right from the get-go, the company's always been trying to do the two things at the same time. So I have a short video that shows, that profiles some of the projects that we've been involved in, and then a little bit afterwards, which is a walkthrough of a website, because what we do is we do a television series and then we do the convergent digital media components that go with it. Collaboration is supremely important to us. We have to have our TV team and our digital media team constantly in conversation and negotiating. We have co-produced with other producers where they bring the creative, we bring the business, or the reverse. We bring the creative and we go somewhere else for the animation because we don't have in-house animation. So we're always dealing with partnerships to make a better product for all of you. So if you could play the video, it'll tell you a bit about Marble.
North America's first live-action animated quiz show that connects with its audience through TV, online, and mobile devices. On TV, real kids compete with each other and cartoon characters in a madcap game show that also delivers a hilarious narrative punch. Online, kids can interact with the wacky world of Scatoonie on the official website. Here, fans can participate in Scatoonie activities led by the flagship Scatoonie Home Game. This season has taken the brand to a whole new level of interactivity and portability with the launch of two iPad games, Find the Earl and Skadoodle. Back on the website, kids will find plenty more interactive entertainment and activities such as the game Earl About Town, a fun puzzle adventure game, and Skarioki, a karaoke simulator. It makes me feel so neat. Players can build their own wallpapers or download a screensaver. And to engage kids offline are CubeCraft characters and downloadable coloring pages.
Yeah!
This site can appeal to a range of interests and ages on multiple devices, with each platform offering unique content exclusively built for that device. A truly whacked out 360-degree property.
And there you have it. Just one interesting note about the whole online experience for kids. When This Is Daniel Cook first started, it was a real effort to convince the broadcasters that preschool children, in fact, were online. So when we first started to develop online capabilities for them, and obviously for their parents, it was a real effort to show that they were in fact already there. They were already playing. So we really wanted to develop that market.
Thank you for that introduction. That was great. Now what I want to do is start with some questions. The first question I want to ask the panel is, so everyone has talked a little bit about how they collaborate within their businesses, but I'm going to ask a very specific question. If you can give one example of where you've collaborated that has been successful and why, that would be very helpful for the audience. And I'm going to start, Peter, with you, to pick on you first.
So I didn't really talk about how we collaborate yet, and I think I just want to add before I answer that question is we collaborate probably throughout our entire process, right from the time we put together a bid to the time we actually deliver the final cut. We would collaborate with various players and vendors in Toronto, where things were successful. I think one area that I think comes up is we were doing Dolphin Tail, and in VFX world, the volume of shots keeps on fluctuating. You know, you start off at X number of shots. Before you know it, the decision has been made that now your shots have doubled, but guess what? The delivery of the film is still middle of September, or whatever the Dolphin Tail delivery was. And so we were in the middle of summer of 2011, and we needed to engage a studio in the city to finish off some of the shots. So we decided which shots are going to go where, and that worked really well, and their price point was competitive, and that seamless delivery when it comes to dealing with the studio in the city and us and really go across to our client as being really one shop that has done everything. I think that's where collaboration is really powerful, and it worked really well for us.
So Peter's giving you an example where they've gone out from a capacity perspective in order to co-partner. Sandra, I'm going to go to you and ask you to talk a little bit about how you collaborate and give a specific example. And here's your challenge. It needs to be different than Peter's.
I think that's been easy, okay, given we do really different things. So we really collaborate from an audience engagement perspective. So our reach is not as wide as we want it to be. Just we're a young festival relative to other festivals in the space. So we just work with other partners from an audience engagement perspective, and also just community development and partnership. So a really good example of that was a film we showed last year called Indie Games, which is a film about indie gamers in Canada and their whole production process to get their games out the door. So we collaborated with an organization called Gamer Camp, which is basically the same thing as TED Talks, but for video game programmers and developers. So we had Gamer Camp help promote the screening, just in terms of getting people out to the screening. And then we actually had them invite Toronto indie gamers to come out to our site and demo a bunch of games. So we had 10 gamers out there, and so we had our audience really having the opportunity to engage with the content and get more excited about the film, and that worked really well for us.
Great. Philippa, if I could go to you at the end, and so you talked a little bit about how you collaborate, but if you want to expand upon that, and then a good example would be great.
Well, I think for us, co-partnering with an animation company is probably the best example that I can think of, because this animation, we do the live action part of it, and the animation company would supply the animation. We do some of our projects are what are called hybrids. They're half live action, half animation. And where it becomes so beneficial is the animation company can access tax incentives that we can't. We can access tax incentives that they can't. And we can put it all together and actually fund the project. So for us, that kind of leveraging the funding and leveraging the skills between the two partners is really important. And that's how we can get a lot of our projects, quite frankly, a lot of them produced.
Okay, now, Strawn, do you want to talk a little bit about either from your perspective or from a customer's perspective?
Sure, yeah, I'll likely do it from a customer's perspective insofar as we facilitate collaboration between customers. In our Vancouver network, we've processed a number of transactions where customers who have excess capacity can sell that capacity back to another customer who, you know, the customer A will have signed on for a 3-year engagement to buy compute and storage capacity from us, and we then, if they don't need it for a period of 3 months, we find somebody else who can use that for a much shorter period of time. That either allows them to take some of that profit back and reinvest in their company or drop their price on the original production that they were bidding for, making them fundamentally more competitive. And so the two companies get to participate together in that sort of mutual sharing. Another thing that we do is just simply physically connect two networks for companies that are working on projects together for a short period of time. That's actually, especially in VFX and CGI, just given the massive amounts of data that are transported back and forth, without a physical network connection, often it's just physically impractical to transfer data back and forth and shots back and forth. So those are, you know, we do it at a very bare bones level. Like I said before, I think the analogy is more like we build the railroad, we don't participate in the actual shipping of goods back and forth, but our goal is to help facilitate that transaction.
One of the things that people always want to ask people that have successfully collaborated is what do you look for in a collaboration partner? So what are some of the things you look for when you're entering into a strategic alliance? And what do you look for as you're going through that collaboration to say that it is successful or not? So how do you identify that you have to part ways? And so I've asked the panelists to think about some of the criteria that they look to when they're entering into a strategic alliance, i.e. what would make a good partner, and secondly, what do they continue to monitor as they're in that relationship to decide that it continues to be a successful relationship or it needs to be one that they mutually agree to part ways with. So what are some of the indicators and factors to look for? So I'll start with you, Sandra. Can you give us a sense of what you look for and when you start to identify you got to part ways?
I think for us it's pretty simple in terms of if reach is what we're looking for, we just want to see how active they are on social media. So likes on Facebook, followers on Twitter, just media attention in general. And then also if they're really on brand for the concept. So for us as well, because we're almost an entirely volunteer-driven organization, it's also ease of collaboration. And then in terms of success, we'll just look at analytics from that night. So in terms of page views, how many referrals we get from that partner attendance that night. And our collaborations have never really been unsuccessful. Like if there's a certain organization that's maybe less on brand for upcoming films, we may not collaborate with them that year. But we've had some really deep-seated collaborations with Hot Docs and other organizations. And they've worked well for us.
Great. Peter, do you have a perspective?
Sure. I think the first thing, we got to get along. I think that has to be the foundation. Whether it's guys at Scalar or another studio in the city or people at Deluxe, like I think we just have to get. We have to be we're people first. So I think that's the first stage. And then it's really do they really understand our business and our industry? Can we talk the same language? So really getting that. The soft evaluation of the soft skills, can we really work together? I think then we look at what's the long-term opportunity in this collaborative relationship. So as we're looking at this one project, what's after that? Like, what is it that we can work together on? So, 1 + 1, it doesn't just equal 2, it equals 5, because now we have there's a really long-term play here. I think in the past where I've made a decision to maybe exit out of a relationship, there's red flags, things start sliding. If you find that you're not if you find that the project is not necessarily their priority, the quality of the materials that they provide haven't really been properly vetted and reviewed, and it looks like there's just sloppiness in it in that conversation. You know there's a problem. You know you're not top of the list. It's always last minute. Delivery dates that start sliding for no other reason other than just not being attentive. And then we just need to look for another partner. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities out there that we can collaborate on, and other people that would be more than keen to work with. So,
yeah, great. Strawn, do you want to talk about from your perspective?
And if
you could focus on divorce, that would be great.
Yeah. Not on divorce. Yeah. Just for a sec, I think, you know, we have an interesting perspective because we get to look at customers who are interested in a one-off transaction, sort of building off what Peter said. They just generally don't find value in the service that we see, and the customers that are looking beyond the next project to two projects to three projects, they're talking to other studios about long-term collaboration, and it's interesting. We see they're not buying our service because of the bells and whistles that we provide. They're much more interested in the opportunity to collaborate with other studios, not on one project or two projects, but for a long-term period, and the fundamental impact that that'll have on their business. I mean, we're nice to have. It could be us or anybody else in the room, but fundamentally, when we bring studios together, they're talking to each other, and then they turn around and say, "Okay, yeah, we'll do your thing." We don't get transactional focused activity. People who are participating in the network are thinking very much long term about how partnerships can impact their overall competitiveness or cost effectiveness. With respect to divorce and risk, I generally have seen it's about an appetite for risk and about customer service. I mean, Peter talked about a good chunk of that when you see deadlines slipping and so on. But generally, we find that the two things that are key in the partnerships that we form and the partnerships that we've observed in running this network to be around appetite for risk and about customer service and a sort of a philosophy approach about how you're going to run that project. And it's been, I think, early on you see warning signs about how that's going to be. But if I were to think about two attributes that should send red flags to people, I would say those two.
Great. Philippa, do you have anything to add to the conversation?
Well, yes, because it's very interesting. So speaking from the creative producing side of things, which is quite different from, the platforms in a way, creators and producers don't generally share well, and they don't play well together, simply because there's a lot of creative control at stake. That said, you know, we all have to work together, and we benefit so much from working together. So battling out creative partnerships with between producers, between creators, is really fundamental, and you end up really stretching what you will give up and what you will attain. And you generally have to give up more than you want to when you're first entering a relationship. But that said, there are so many benefits down the road. So there are many cautionary points, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. You need to have a really good legal agreement. And it's important when you're searching for partners that you find partners that are interested in the same things. And that this is in my experience, that the benefits that the partnership are going to gain are relatively equal, so that you're not terribly one-sided, so that one party thinks that they're hard done by. Because from what I've sort of experienced, that's where things can go off the rail, when one of the partners feels they're not getting what they should have gotten or could have gotten out of the relationship. But if you can work out the mutual benefits and that it's in everyone's interest, despite any creative disputes, to get to the finish line and end up with something. So there's lots of pitfalls, but there's lots of benefits too. So there are many creative ways to get around the issues, and legal ways to get around the issues.
So the last question, and I'm going to ask Peter to address it, is, you know, so everyone's talked about ways that we collaborate today around, for talent, for capacity, co-productions, engagement, and making sure people are aware of your event. I'd like Peter to talk about where do we think collaboration needs to go in order for Ontario media companies to be successful?
So we talked about this before the call, so this was like a cue that I'm supposed to talk about.
You're supposed to say it's just off the cuff, Peter.
I think where we need to be, you know, at some point in the future, there's a lot of successful places around the world that do this collaboration really well, like Soho, Net in UK, whether they're doing things well today as well as they've done it before, it's quite a question, but it is a structure that is out there. Vancouver, as we were talking, has done things really well from the technology collaboration perspective. But I think the ideal, at least from my perspective, is if someone's coming to us with a project, they're not coming just to ARC. They're coming to Ontario to do a film. If they're going to contact us or somebody else in a city with, 1,000 shots or 1,500 shots, which quite frankly, it's just too much for us just to do on our own. We should be coming to them with a play of going, okay, we're working together with 3 or 4 studios. And therefore, when we start putting together a bid, it's a collaborative bid on a project. It's not everybody's fighting in a city against each other to bring work here. It's the work's coming here, and we're working together to win that work into Toronto. And then after that, it's really, getting to a position where we can be a one-stop place where we do all our audio work in a city. It doesn't have to go across the country or to another country, and then really continue to reevaluate our competition out in China and India and what makes our what is it that makes us competitive compared to the fact that we're in the same time zone, that we're Canadian, and we're just so nice and so honest a lot of times, and so transparent. I mean, I continually have conversations with clients where they just go, geez, you guys are just so open about how you do things. It's just so much better than taking things somewhere else. And getting that transparency between studios in a city to work together on a project, whether it's visual effects, live action, or animation, I think it's quite powerful and very appealing to folks in our industry. And then taking that right into looking at, Sheridan College is the best animation school in the world that we have just in our backyard. We work very closely with the school we have 40, just so people, out of 220, we have 40 people out of Sheridan working for us. They go to Pixar, and we wish them farewell and welcome them back. We work very closely with them to participate on their PAC committees and so on and so forth to provide feedback on their curriculum, and continue the conversation about internships and things like that. We also work with other colleges and schools in the city. And I think that's where looking at the various pieces. And I see that's where OMDC comes in. Is almost like a glue to everything, getting us all into a room and go, okay, what can we do to make things better? How transparent do we have to be to each other, and how forward-looking do we have to be to make a game plan for 5, 10, 20, 15 years down the road, and where do we want to see ourselves, and how do we want to pitch ourselves to the market?
Great.
So hopefully that answers your question.
Yep, so Peter's thrown something out there.
what I'm going to do is now ask the audience if you have any questions for the panel. So if you can wait for a mic, that would be great.
Hi. Peter Miller, I'm a lawyer and currently chair of the board of Interactive Ontario. And I want to pick up on your comment, Peter, just now. And I'd like to give a little context, if I may. About 5 or 6 years ago, the government of Ontario set a policy called Creative Clusters. You may have or may not have heard of the policy, but at its essence was both a geographic and a concept that the six creative industries work together in Ontario. And if you look at what's happened in the last decade or so, you've seen indicators of how this has progressed. Everything from recruiting companies like Ubisoft to Ontario, encouraging foreign service production. All of the measures we have in place that are different for each of the sectors that support them. And you've alluded to it as well, Peter, the very deliberate attempts that OMC has made to bring sectors together to encourage understanding and collaboration. So I guess my question is, what more can be done in that area? And is it important? Is that a competitive edge we have? Do you see around the world a lot of examples? You cited Vancouver in the UK, but is that an edge we have? And what should public policy be doing? One of the things that we're looking at, actually, is just the digital media tax credit, which doesn't allow partnerships because of the 90% rule. That's something that we're looking at encouraging would be changed. But I'm just curious as to, from your own perspectives, if government or OMDC has a role to play to improve the situation, or whether, quite frankly, it's just up to us.
I think what's been done, what government has done is set the almost like a foundation and the rules to play by. I think it's really up to us to at least from my perspective, get into into a meeting room and just hash it out. Like I really think people have a tendency of really still being only working in their own backyard, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to have the conversations first before we identify what are the gaps. I think I'm going to almost say, like, I think we have to have these meetings and conversations first, and people have to open up and to working together more. Before we can define what are the asks for, what are the roadblocks that various spaces, and it could be tax credits, could be the way that some of the eligibility of certain things, could be the process of getting tax credits certified. I mean, that takes a long, long time right now. If you look at one area that government can help via policy and throw some more people and bodies on it, that's one place. It's becoming challenging for us to compete in this space when we say, hey, we got tax credits come play in our backyard because we can provide you all these discounts. But guess what? We're going to have to finance the tax credits for 18 to 24 months. And that's a really long receivable, and it's really expensive. So so then you have a conversation with the client and go, okay, well, geez, I wish I could offer you these tax credits, but I have to factor in, if you're going to do them with me, how long it's going to take us to get these things back, and therefore I can only provide you X dollars of discount. I think if there was a place that government can really help is look at that and go, okay, how can they make that process better and work with the banks and evaluate. The risk and educate the banks around setting up facilities that can work with the credits and all that kind of stuff. I think that's where, if the government was going to play, I think that's the area to play.
Okay, so Peter's talked about He's given a good perspective. Philippa, I can see that you're eager to participate in the conversation, so that's great.
Okay, I just wanted to mention another initiative. So Canada and Ontario have a long history of treaty co-productions with film and television, and we've been pushing for a long time for a digital media co-production structure, and those conversations are just starting to happen, and that's something that the government could really help us with too, because that would mean that we could really expand co-producing digital media elements around the world, the way we have taken such great advantage of television, film and television treaty co-productions. So there's that aspect of it that I think would make a big difference.
Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you. Hi. Peter Grant. I'm interested in the area. I've been reading in the last few months about the layoffs happening in the special effects and visual effects industry, particularly in the United States. We saw that the company that did the effects for Life of Pi went bankrupt. James Cameron's company went into receivership and was later Digital Domain, was bought by a Chinese company. So I've seen a lot of stories recently about the problems in the visual effects industry. There's an enormous level of competition and so on. In that sense, how do you see the prospects for this in Canada? Obviously, we're competing in a global environment here, but what do we have to offer that they don't?
Who wants to take that one?
Given that I'm in a space, I can probably address that. I don't think there's an easy answer. I mean, I don't think this is a recipe that if you shall do this, this is going to fix the whole visual effects space. I think visual effects and animation is probably two different beasts. That's important to understand as well. When you're talking animation, that's a long-term production with long deadlines and high costs and lots of people. If you have a problem, a storm coming, you'll know that storm is coming before it hits you. Okay, in the visual effects space. It's complete opposite. The life cycle and how these companies get into a Life of Pi or whatnot happens really quickly. Like you could be, you know, and when we work on an animated film, we've been talking to various people about a property for 2 or 3 years before it happens. You very well could be talking about an animated or a visual effects property a month before it hits your shop, there's very little time to really evaluate what does that mean to the business. Do you have the right level of technology? Have you partnered up with the right partners to be able to address their render needs? What legal paperwork do you have in place to protect you if the film doesn't? It goes beyond budget. Is there a way for you to get to go on hold? Are there break fees? All that kind of stuff that it almost gets forgotten, and it's so critical when the period of getting into production happens so quickly. And then delivery doesn't change. So now you're into this, into the VFX process, which everybody says we'll just fix that in post. Okay. So then you got into an agreement where you do 500 shots, and then through the we will fix it in post process, all of a sudden that became 1,200 shots, and there was no mechanism. There may be no mechanism in the contract that allows for additional 700 shots to be addressed. And guess what? Who's gonna be on the hook to do it? It's the visual effects house that's now on the hook. And then the issue with the industry is as well is that there has been expectation to our visual effects group works a lot different, has a lot of different types of hours in a way as animation. In some ways, when there's a project deadline, all of a sudden you find that part of the business just the hours just become crazy. That incremental time doesn't necessarily get factored in or recovered. So you take all of these things, and these are just what you maybe consider a simple business evaluation or things that people need to consider that are moving at such a fast pace that companies like Rhythm and Hues or Digital Domain and many others, even they have been such a big players in this space, unfortunately resulted in what happened. But I mean, I'm talking more from an observer perspective. This is what may have happened. There may have been so many other factors that triggered this. But there's a recurring issue with VFX, which is it's a very expensive beast to make, and every film needs it, and evaluating how much it costs is an issue.
It's interesting. We have a bit of a perspective on this issue specifically, because it's really what our goal is to try and fix. I mean, I think VFX has a specific structural business problem where there's abnormal amounts of demand, and you have to buy at least currently, a fixed amount of capacity, and that is really hard to do. Because you are either buying more capacity than you need in the future, and it goes underutilized, or you have to say no to certain deals, and you're still wondering about your overall capacity utilization. So in terms of competitiveness, services like SohoNet and services that allow companies to collaborate, I think, improve your overall level of competitiveness. And to the gentleman's earlier question about what government agencies can do, I mean, we certainly participate in the technology element of it, but when we're speaking to CGI and VFX houses, being able to flow up and down with respect to technical infrastructure they want, but physical infrastructure, space, artists, labor, financing, the entire production process needs, we are one small cog and we're excited about that, but there's a lot of different pieces that need to come together. So with respect to public policy and what we can do to encourage our competitiveness, in that respect, there's a number of other cogs in the wheel or in the machine that can be improved to help companies scale up and scale down to meet that demand.
Thanks for that. I was almost going to go back to your picture.
Peter
also talked about that. It's the ability to bring companies together and be able to service a demand and then retrench and then service a demand so that you're not necessarily trying to do it on your own, and why collaboration and bringing various parties together is so important to survive the ebbs and flows of all the demands that are put on your time as a media company. Are there any other questions from the audience? Sure, okay, we've got two here.
Hi, Steven Mirlo from Polar Mobile. One level of collaboration we haven't talked about is with advertisers or agencies. Hmm. In my world, which is bringing print publications to mobile applications, native advertising is seen as sort of a silver bullet for these publications to make money online or on mobile. I guess, Philippa, this question's more for you. How do you collaborate with brands or agencies, or can you, or do you, and how does that affect or alter the creative process?
We are limited, certainly on the television side, because of the no advertising for children's programming. So we can't put, you know, Rice Krispies on the screen. But those holds are not in place on the digital media side. So we try and work very closely with brands, with marketing, for the benefit of both. Our television broadcaster is the one that usually takes all those sponsorship models and the advertising models. They look at it as it's revenue to them, which they are not interested in sharing with us. If we can bring sponsors or bring interested brands to them, that works well. But we're limited to what we can do just because we're in the children's market. It's not, we're tr- trying to explore things, but it's not easy.
But it is a good question. So you see some of the digital, I can't think of the name, but the marketplace that where you can sell and barter. Digital advertising is a good example where we're trying to get better with the collaboration around advertising. So how do you take that digital example back into the traditional arena is perhaps a challenge. There was another question here.
I have a question about agreements, and I was wondering, I had a lot of problems in post-production when I was finishing my feature, and the agreements were very clear. Now, I didn't have a contract, but I mean, the deadlines, it wasn't just a problem with the sound, it was a problem with the sound and the visual too. So we had an agreement for how many hours I would be using the facilities, which specific device they'd be using to do the color on, and nothing that was agreed to was, I mean, not nothing, but I mean, the quantity was less, the amount of time estimated to do it was more. What I mean, and obviously you don't want to be litigious, you don't want to go around suing everybody that works for you, but I mean, how do you manage those? I guess this is sort of more for Peter and Philippa, but how do you manage those issues?
Our agreements have a very defined assumptions and details. We wouldn't go into a project without having assumptions that make up our bid or back up our bid, and then a detailed assumptions around technology of how we deliver and all that kind of stuff. We involve our production people in evaluating and review of the agreements before the agreements go into signature. So I wear a business affairs hat in my world, but I wouldn't feel comfortable having executed the agreement without having, our head of production involved, our the producer that's responsible for that involved, and they need to own these assumptions. If we haven't spelled out assumptions in enough detail for them, that gets updated, and we go through it back and forth negotiation with the client. Or financier to conclude what that ultimate language is. If we go to the next issue, which is answering questions, going now we have a problem. Assumptions changed. If we get to the end, it's a little too late. Now they've got the car delivered. The ship has sailed. I think the key thing for us is how we are successful at what we do is we need to identify changes in assumptions. If that only results in $10,000 change or $5,000 or whatever that small amount is, that may very well trigger a change order. We evaluate at that time as to, okay, is that a problem or is it their problem? And if it's something that was triggered by a client, then we go to them at that time and go, okay, listen, this assumption's changed now, that's resolved to X costs, and then we have that change order approved. If they push on old assumptions and they change the story back to be budget neutral, then that's the decision that's been made to avoid that cost. But we wouldn't necessarily proceed without having a resolution. And that resolution very well be we eat the costs.
Philippa.
Well, I was just to address it from a small producer's perspective, which I think it's easy to run into that kind of problem. I think what we have found is you have to have someone, either a post supervisor or post production coordinator or somebody who's on that all the time, because the post houses get busy and their priorities change and they push things around and it's another client comes in and they promise that machine to them and you get bumped down, and you really need to have somebody who's constantly in dialogue with them advocating for your project through the system. I know it's time consuming, but necessary.
Would penalties be a part of the contract, or how would you enforce it? I mean, there's nothing to enforce it. why would they bother to honor an agreement at all?
Well, they don't generally want to piss off their clients because they do want you to come back for work, and word of mouth can travel very quickly. I mean, in the contracts that you would have, there would be penalties built in. You have a document that basically outlines exactly what the deliverables are and the requirements are, and then you also have a monetary factor attached to any changes, so that if there's a change, then they have to pay, or they have to cover it. You know, there's a way to build in penalties, but you know, you need to sign a contract as opposed to just relying on their invoices.
I think it really comes down to fairness. I think if you feel that you're not going to be fairly treated in an agreement, you shouldn't be going to that agreement. Like, I mean, that's the bottom line. Like, those clauses are in the contract to protect all the parties. But we don't really want to get into exercising those clauses.
No.
Yeah, but the time it comes to that, something...
But sometimes you don't know.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Right. But you want to have a fair partner at the end of the game. You want to be fairly treated, and you want to come from the conversation going, listen, this is a post-mortem, and we haven't been fairly treated. How are we going to address that? Is it going to be on this agreement, or are you giving me a deal on next thing? Like, how are we going to resolve this today so that way we can continue working?
Yeah, so I think, unfortunately, we are way over our time.
I'm just going to say one more thing.
Okay, she's going to say one
more
thing.
You withhold the last payment is what you do.
So there's always
leverage. And then you negotiate from there.
Yeah. So Peter and Philippa have said something that's really important, which is always be having these dialogues as you're creating what you're producing, because if you have it after you've delivered or after they've delivered, you lose your leverage. But I just want to wrap it up. Thank you, panelists, for participating today. I think it was a great dialogue. You got some different perspectives. And I think the number one thing to remember is that strategic alliances will help us as Canadians and as Ontarians in order to be successful. So let's keep working in this area. Thank you.